the many times that we've sat down to talk, I'm always taken back to the one time that you were here in Chicago. You know exactly what I'm going to say, don't you?
I know exactly. We you haven't had an interview in that office before.
I have
You haven't seen
and have never since either out in the middle of a snowstorm,
that.
sitting out in Grant Park. You were touring the country, and it remains one of the most memorable interviews that I've ever done in my life.
Well, that was a grand experiment. My buddy and I pulled the Airstream around America. We put over 13,000 miles under us. And I remember, when we got up in the Northeast, when we got in there around Chicago, it was snow, it was cold. But it was a fun adventure. I
It was
haven't done
fun.
a press junket like that yet either.
Yeah, it was fun. I just remember you and I like two idiots sitting out in the cold and the snow, trying to pretend like nothing was going on. It
I
was.
figured, the weather, doing the interviews like that, it just kind of inevitably cuts the pretense out of everything because the
Yeah.
elements are tough. And you're like, okay, let's get down to it.
Well, I mean, you do a million of these interviews. I do a million of these interviews. To have, something that both of us remember so vividly, mission accomplished is all I
Yes,
can say on your part.
indeed.
Man, mission accomplished on this book of just a thoughtful and interesting guidebook on what you've been through in your life, Green Lights. Explain what the concept was and how you decided to do this.
Well, so I've been keeping a journal slash diaries for 36 years. So I've got thousands of pages, hundreds of different journals that I've been collecting and putting Ziploc bags and put them in this treasure chest. And about 15 years ago, started threatening to go away and see if there were things in those journals that were worthy of putting into a book. And I didn't have the courage to do it. I finally got the courage about 2.5 years ago, and I went away. And I remember when I first sat down, I took them all away to this little shed in the desert just so I would be stuck with nothing but me and myself in the last 50 years, AKA my journals. And I had an idea of what I thought they were going to be. And I actually thought they were going to be very academic. And as I got into it, I started going, this is actually more a little more poetic than academic. And all of a sudden, I remember going, stop. Let's just see what they are. Let them reveal themselves. And what came out of it, this, I ended up with seven stacks in front of me. They were stories, people, places, prescribes, poems, prayers, and a whole lot of bumper stickers. And those were the seven stacks. And then I said, okay, well, let's get into that and see if the central theme comes out. And the central theme that came out was the green light theme. I noticed that I caught green lights in my life, meaning things that are more freedom, being kind to our future self, delayed gratification, what have you. I caught a lot of those by decisions I had made. So I designed them. By decisions and responsibilities I took for myself. I had some green lights that just fell in my lap. And I was like, whoa, I just got lucky. Where'd this come from? Thank you. And then I had quite a few that were all about perspective, meaning I would hit a bump in the road and maybe not even give the crisis credit, AKA the yellow light, not even give it credit, just blow right through it, that hardship, and say, I'm not even going to give that crisis credit. I'm going to make it a green light. And then I also ultimately found this was the real lesson in it, that the red and yellow lights in my life, the hardships, the pauses, the things that made me stop, the things I didn't want at the time, turned out to be things that I needed because there were lessons that I needed to learn that were inherent in them that I either realized at the time, the next day, the next week, 10 years later, and some I still haven't even realized yet, but believe that they will eventually reveal their green light assets via lessons learned in some time in my life.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a great learning experience, really, that we all face green lights and red lights and yellow lights and, all of these great metaphors that are the sum total of our lives that hopefully we learn from, that red lights do turn into green lights and, that
And the
we.
fact that if they were all green, if life was all green lights, it wouldn't be about anything. It'd be about nothing more than entertainment. And so that, those yellows where we're forced to pause or be introspective or reapproach a situation, those serve us many times. We don't like them. But I think the sooner we can sit there and look and go, okay, I may not like this situation. This may be a hardship. This may be a crisis, but let me without denying the crisis, how can I opine and kind of figure out what's the value in this for me? And there's usually something to find.
I always find it so interesting when somebody writes a book about their life or their experiences, that they put all the warts and all out there. They put it all out there. Is that difficult to do? I mean, to tell difficult and painful things that happened in your life?
It wasn't really difficult. I tell you what would be difficult and what I haven't done is I would never do it, say, in this format. Or on a talk show, or with in a long form interview, or in a periodical, because there's a lot of things that I know exactly what I mean to say, and I wanted to make sure that if it's by my hand, I can give context to the situation. It's in my words. There's a lot of things I wouldn't want to share, and hadn't shared before, and probably won't share in the future, that I'm like, I'm not going to give that to someone else to let them put their spin on that. I don't want to, you know, what it's too many times, you know, that the headline. It's why, for instance, I didn't bring up and go into details about molestation earlier on in my life, or being blackmailed into having sex. I'm like, you know what? There was nothing constructive there. If I explain that, someone's going to make that the headline of the book. And that's not what it's about. And that would be derailing people from the theme of the book. So it wasn't hard, actually. It was quite freeing to say, and that's exactly how I mean to say it and how it went down. So therefore, it's in my words. I can't be misquoted. You can't grab a sentence out of there, but it's a book. So people, if you read the thing, you get the context of each story.
Yeah, it's very interesting because, you know, until I got my copy of the book, all I had heard were some of the flashy headlines that were being revealed. And then I read about an interview, I think it was in Australia or somebody or someplace in a non-American country, that asked you about politics. And you, the way that you answered the question was that you would only do it in a long form way, so nothing could be taken out of context and become the headline that you wanted everything put in context, was such a brilliant way of framing it. And then as I went through the book myself, I could see exactly what you were doing with all that.
Yeah, I mean, I've become aware, you know, over doing this for 30 something years of what the format is. There's a different tone. There's a different subject matter, different energy I'll take to a talk show that's going to be a 5-minute piece than I'm going to take to an hour and a half podcast. I try to get Q&As for everything that's written in a periodical. Like, can I have the question and the answer? Because I mean what I'm saying, but boy, sometimes someone doesn't get it. I'll read it. I go, oh no, that isn't what I meant, or they paraphrase or something. Right. And so I'm aware of that, and I know, you know, especially the question like that. I think it was I forget who it was that asked me about politics, and they had asked me about Trump, and I was like, no, not right here. I get that. What if I say one thing? You now, especially in election year, is the time where you go, bam, you know. McConaughey feels this, and I was like, no, it's not. It's not enough context. It's not the right format. They're not a platform.
Yeah, best response yet that I've heard to pesky questions that we ask about stuff like that. I would like high five you if you responded to me about a question like that, because that was a brilliant response in my book. You know, you do explain a lot, and your life experiences, and your highs and your lows. And you talk about your family and your kids. I wonder, like, what kind of advice would you give your kids? Would you want them to have as many green lights as possible, or would you also want them to experience red lights so they appreciate the green lights when they finally come?
Gotta have the shadows to appreciate the light. Have to. As I was saying earlier, if it's off, life's all green lights. If life is one big yes, you're just going to run in circles and get dizzy and burn out. You know, if life's nothing but candy, well, your teeth are going to rot out pretty quickly. And you're going to look up and go, wow, this was short money. Also, you know, there's different kinds. We have to watch what kind of green lights we get. Many of them are fads. They're lust. They're an immediate gratification, but they're only battery powered. They're not going to beam green for eternally. So I'm not trying to teach our children, look, seek the eternal, infinitely glowing green lights in life, the things that will pay you back, not just now, but will pay you back through the rest of your life on your deathbed, and you will, they will keep shining after you're gone. What are those green lights? Long money, you know? So you have to have the reds and the yellows. And realize that, you know, and look, my kids are growing up in an affluent household. We were one of the haves, you know? And so Camille and I continually try to watch with our children. Okay, we don't want to deny that. We want to help them have be abreast of the affluence that we have, but to respect it, meaning there's a great lesson I taught them after I won the Best Actor for Dallas Buyers Club. They're like, what's the trophy for? And I said, well, you remember a year and a half ago when Dad was, you know, you'd wake up every morning, Dad was gone. He'd get home at night. You look at him, he said, I look like a giraffe. I was so skinny. Like, yeah, I remember that. I go, well, the work I was doing every day there, a year and a half later, my peers gave me a trophy and said, this is, you did excellent. And they got the first time they ever clicked on delayed gratification, that your future is a compounding asset. And what you do today is building towards those assets, good or bad. And so that's what, you know, we try and get them to understand that things are supposed to be hard, and some good, and a lot of things worth having are very hard and should be. And those can come in the form of yellow and red lights.
I love what a thoughtful, dedicated dad you are, you know, especially from the guy that we knew as the bongo playing wild child from.
I still play those bongos.
Hopefully a little more clothed than you did back in the day, right?
Hopefully not, but yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. I had read that you wish you could have 8 more kids. Your wife doesn't agree with you on this, but you love being a dad, don't you?
I do. As I say in the book, it's the only thing I ever knew I wanted to be in life. And I remember it was 8 years old and I was meeting some of my dad's friends, and he was a big sirs and ma'ams, please and thank you, man. So, you know, you shake a man's hand, you look him in the eye. Nice to meet you, sir. Nice to meet you, sir. Nice to meet you, sir. And I remember in my 8-year-old mind going, oh, you know what the common denominator about all these men that I'm having to call sir, the common denominator is that they're all dads. And in my mind, I was like, oh, that's when you've made it. That's when you've succeeded in life. And I had great reverence for fatherhood and still do. And as you know, are you a father?
I'm not.
You're not. Well, as you, when you, if you know, when I became a father, it was like, oh, okay. Well, just helping make the child is not being a father. You may biologically have been a father, but now the fatherhood is the verb. Now the work comes, you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. That's why I value so much my nieces and nephews, because they, like, they're sort of my kids. And, you know, I can help them with some of those things along the way. What are you doing during the quarantine? How are you getting by with?
Relatively, we're doing well. We're here in Austin, Texas. My children are remote schooling. My 88-year-old mother is with us. She's been with us for 7 months. So sometimes we have 4 kids in the house, counting her. For the most part, you know, she's getting so, you know, talk about what are the green light assets of a quarantine. For us, my mother is getting to see her grandkids every single day. Which without the quarantine, she'd see them once every 2 weeks. There's value in that. Well, the kids will remember this. Mom's going to remember this. We're sitting down, you know, have a lot more home cooked meals where we sit down, we make the food and we sit down and say our gratitudes and have meals together and talk about our day. My kids are doubling down on some of their creative hobbies that I don't think they would have taken the time to do if life was going on as it was. For me, the some people I've noticed if I really have to start fighting even boredom. You know it from the book. I'm very comfortable in solitude. I don't have any itch to get off the property. I'm like, oh, this is great right here, and I'm in a position where the pantry's full. There's a lot of this interaction remote that I prefer now. There are quite a few interactions where I'm like, oh, I'd rather be there in person. Oh, I want to give that person a hug. Oh, I want to high five that person. Oh, you know, but some of this, I'm like, it's just gonna, how much of this is going to be the new normal, even if we all get to a time where we feel like it's completely safe to go reengage.
Yeah, that's how I felt like in the beginning of doing all of this, these Zoom interviews and interacting with people virtually seemed so weird. And I recently just did an interview with Slash, you know, from Guns N' Roses. Yes. He happened to be in Chicago, and I interviewed him one on one. And I said to him, "You're the first actual person that I've stood in front of and right. interviewed in 6 months. This is really weird. It was really weird. The body language, and looking at his body language and seeing everything like I've done for 30 years.
Yeah.
That you don't always see in these yeah. Zoom interviews. So it really has become the new normal. I think it's on both of our ends.
In a way, it'll be nice to be free to roam again. But you know, I'm not driving as much here at the house. So when I go out for a drive, I've got to actually check myself. I'm going, wait a minute, are you driving okay? You haven't done this in a while. And it's a bit surreal. Yeah.
Yeah. So, just my final question, I guess, for you. Do you want to punch somebody when they say, all right, all right, all right, to you? If you hear that one more time, are you going to scream?
No, I'm not. I actually, look, those are the first three words I ever said in film. In a summer in 1992 on the film Dazed and Confused, my first night on a set, first night acting in a scene that we improvised, that I didn't know at that time if that was going to be the one night I worked in this little hobby, this little fun night I had in 92 and never acted again. And it turned out to be 28 years later, a career for me. So when I hear it, that's a call back to my inception of when I started doing what I've grown to love to do, act and tell stories. So when someone says it, they may not know it, but I'm like, yep, that's the beginning. That is actually the beginning for me. So I take it as I have a little bit of honor in it.
Sure puts a smile on my face every time that I hear it. And every time that, you know, I see you say it when you won your Oscar, you know, when it just doesn't seem like it would come up and you inject it. It's like, all right, there you are. All right, all right, all right. There's Matthew. There's my pal.
Well, you know, and if someone says it, they're usually in a pretty good mood. They're usually about to offer something that you want or, you know, it's an affirmative. You can use it. If someone's saying that coming into a situation, you have better chances of that being a situation you want to be in.
Yeah, that's true. But nobody says it like you. Nobody does it like you. Hey, congratulations on the book. I really, really, really enjoyed it. It's great to see you. All the best to you and the family. And one of these days, face to face again, I hope.
We'll see you on the other side in a snowy park.
Okay. I'll bring the lawn chairs.